Lemoyne had started strategizing from the moment he had seen the body. He had put his arms around Mira not to console her, but to hold her still while he ran through various plays and counterplays in his mind, gaming out his options, bracketing the things he could not change. Darvish was dead. Shelley was tripping on acid that he, Lemoyne, had given her. From the things that could possibly be altered or massaged, Darvish had been hit by the van, Shelley had been driving it. And when after a couple of seconds, Mira had tried to extricate herself from his embrace, pushing away from his chest with her forearms, craning her neck to turn and look again at the corpse where it lay flung out and staring on the gravel drive, Lemoyne had gripped her even tighter, murmuring, "Trust me, don't look," until she stopped struggling and began to cry. It was a bad situation. Darvish was still the legal owner of the property. He'd been killed on his own driveway, on his own land, in front of his own house, by a trespasser blitzed out of her mind on an illegal drug that Lemoyne had personally imported to the country. And the only reason he'd been walking up his driveway in the first place, alone and in the dark, was because Lemoyne had changed the code on his front gate and hadn't let him know. And that wasn't all. In the shearing shed at the bottom of the hill were five other trespassers in the same blitzed-out condition, any one of whom might have seen Shelley drive away into the dark, any one of whom might have heard the Vinette collide with Darvish and then swerve and crash into the poplar at the driveway's edge, any one of whom might be about to appear, at any moment, to ask in psychedelic stupefaction what the hell was going on. Even if there was a way, somehow, of waiting out the collective acid trip, even if Lemoyne could think up a reason to delay calling the police until the effect of the drug had subsided, even if the man's death could be made to seem purely like an accident, a misfortune for which nobody could be blamed, not Shelley, not Burnham Wood, and certainly not Lemoyne. Even then, there was no getting around the trespassing. There was no getting around the fact that the Burnham crew were squatting at the farm without the knowledge or permission of either Darvish or his wife. Their camp in the shearing shed was plainly long established. Their many beds and plantings were proof in themselves of how long they had been living there, at Lemoyne's invitation, with Lemoyne's encouragement, and, as Mira's bank records could prove, on Lemoyne's dollar. Once all of that got out, Lemoyne thought, his mind turning fast, once Jill Darvish learned the circumstances of her husband's death, once she discovered all the ways in which Lemoyne had deceived her husband, had caused his death, effectively, for no better reason than out of malice and for sport, Lemoyne could hardly expect that she would want to honor their agreement, proceeding with the sale and subdivision, making him her future next-door neighbor for heaven's sake, by selling him the greater portion of the beloved acreage where she'd grown up. No. The millions that Lemoyne had dangled would now seem offensive and obscene, a slight against the memory of her husband, an outrage against her. She wouldn't just back out of the sale, which was still well within her power. Very probably she would litigate against him. The case would be all over the news. They'd be in and out of courtrooms for years. It would be public. It would be poisonous. It would be louder than loud. And what would happen in the meantime to the extraction site in Kotawai and the mercenaries awaiting his instructions and all their processing equipment and the rare earth motherlode itself? No. Lemoyne thought again, shaking his head almost imperceptibly, his chin resting on Mira's hair. No, he couldn't risk Jill Darvish finding out the truth, which meant the truth was going to have to change. His gaze came to rest on the body. Disappearing it was not an option. He could not afford to invite a search and rescue manhunt to the region that might uncover his operation in the national park. Darvish would have to be found, and quickly. But this posed a problem, for the sooner the body was found, the more tools a coroner would have at his disposal to establish both time of death and cause. Lemoyne knew already that the CCTV at the petrol station covered the main highway in both directions. The SUV that Darvish was driving would have been clocked by the camera as he drove in, probably around half an hour ago. And of course the onward road over the pass was closed. To drive his body out again and stage his death elsewhere would create a time discrepancy. It would also beg the question as to why Darvish might have left his own property so soon after his arrival, which itself might raise suspicions. Lemoyne had no way of knowing how many of the few remaining residents of Thorndyke had seen his aircraft coming in to land that afternoon. But even if that number was zero, the plane was still parked up at the airstrip in plain view. and an easy search of the traffic out of Thorndyke in the past few hours would prove that he had not left the property by car. What was more, it was a rented plane, and he had called the landing in. His flight log placed him squarely at the farm. To take off now would create another time discrepancy, a memorable one, since small planes did not tend to fly at night. So his options were severely limited. Lemoyne tried to visualize the man's last movements. Darvish had driven up to his front gate, wound down his window, tried the code, probably several times without success. Had he seen a far glow of light inside the shearing shed? Had he heard distant music wafting over the fields? Lemoyne made a mental note to check if the shed was within sight of the gate. Well, in any case, he thought, Darvish had tried the intercom, and when nobody had answered, he had gotten out of the car and climbed over the gate to walk up to the house on foot, certainly frustrated, possibly even angry, that the code had somehow been changed. Had he called somebody? His wife? To ask if she'd ever had any trouble in putting the code, perhaps? Or a neighbor? Or even a locksmith? The security company that had fitted the keypad? If he had, then help could be already on the way. Abruptly, Lemoyne let go of Mira and went over to the body. In Darvish's left trouser pocket, he could see a flat rectangle, his phone. He knelt down and eased it out, and then, avoiding looking at the dead man's face, he slid the phone carefully under the lifeless hand and pressed Darvish's thumb onto the sensor button to unlock the screen with his fingerprint. Shelley was watching him. "Who is that man?" she said. Lemoyne ignored her. He went to the call history first, to discover that the last call that Darvish had made, to his wife, had been at 3:30 that afternoon. It had lasted 1 minute and 29 seconds. Relieved, Lemoyne opened his messages. The last text message Darvish had received had come in at 5:12 p.m. It was from his son, Jesse, and it said, "Hey, Dad, were you and Uncle Mac invited to Kieran's stag do?" At 6:33, Darvish had texted back, "Don't think so, when is it?" And that was the end of the thread. "Who is that man?" Shelley said again. And then Mira said, from behind him, "She doesn't know." Lemoyne looked up, first at Shelley, whose expression was plaintive, both hands clutching strangely at her neck, and then at Mira.
"What?"
he said.
"She doesn't know,"
Mira said again. Her voice was thick.
"None of them do."
"What do you mean?" he said. "None of them know what?"
Mira was crying again. She covered her face.
"Who is he?"
Shelley said, stroking her throat with both hands in a strange, compulsive motion.
"What's he doing here?"
Lemoyne got up, walked over to the van and opened the rear doors.
"Where did he come from?"
Shelley said, still stroking.
"Is he dead?"
"Don't worry," said Lemoyne. "He isn't real."
"He isn't?"
said Shelley. She looked doubtfully at the body.
"No," said Lemoyne. "None of this is real. It's a simulation."
"Oh,"
she said without understanding.
"What for?"
He put his hand under her armpit and hauled her to her feet.
"Get in the van," he said.
Meekly, she complied.
"I need you to count to 5,000, he said. "But you have to say every single number. You can't miss any of them. All right? It's important. It's part of the exercise."
"What exercise?"
she said.
"I'll explain it at the end," he said. "Now let me hear you. One."
"One,"
said Shelley obediently.
"Two. Three. Four."
"Good," he said. "Keep going. Don't stop."
He shut the door on her and looked at Mira.
"What did you tell them?" he said.
She was standing just beyond the red wash of light thrown by the van's taillights. The indicator was still going, bing, bing, bing. And it occurred to Lemoyne that it might be wise not to drain the battery. The hood was dented and steaming, and the windscreen cracked. But there was a chance that the thing could still be driven. He went around to the driver's seat and turned the key, cutting the light and the noise. Mira hadn't moved when he came back.
"I didn't lie," she said. "I didn't make anything up. I just left some things out."
"What things? The money?"
"No,"
she said, looking shocked.
"No."
"What then?"
"Him,"
She pointed at the body without looking at it.
And his wife.
Why? Said Lemoyne.
She took a shuddering breath.
Because...
He wanted to slap her. Why? He said again louder. Hurry up.
Because people might not have come otherwise, she burst out. They might not have wanted to. We put it to a vote. I didn't want to lose the vote.
He kept his expression stony, but inside he felt a great relief. So she had something to hide, just as he did. So she was deceiving Burnham Wood, just as he was. That was useful. The tears were coursing down her cheeks.
We should call an ambulance, she said.
He doesn't need an ambulance, said Lemoyne. He's dead. He tilted the man's phone to wake up the display, but the screen had locked again, so he walked back to the body and knelt down in the gravel a second time to press the dead man's thumb to the sensor. Rigor mortis would set in soon, he thought. Already Darvish's blood would be pooling in his bottom and his back, and the impression of the gravel might be leaving its mark as well. They ought to get him back in the driver's seat of the SUV as soon as possible.
What are you doing?
Mira said. Lemoyne didn't answer. He opened Darvish's email app, searching for a clue as to why the man had unexpectedly come home. Scrolling back through his inbox, he found an Air New Zealand boarding pass purchased on Monday evening for a return flight from Wellington to Christchurch. The ticket was for a single seat, departing mid-afternoon on Friday and scheduled to fly back on Sunday night. Included in the booking was a 2-day rental car hire. So the SUV was a rental then. That meant the engine would be in fairly good condition, Lemoyne thought, still running through his options. It also meant that the odometer would have been recorded at the time that Darvish picked it up. He could find nothing in the man's inbox to explain why he might have made the trip. So he clicked on the sent folder instead. Scrolling down, he saw his own address. This was the email that Darvish had sent to him about the conservation project launch on Tuesday, that he'd deleted without reading. He opened it and saw the postscript at the bottom for the first time.
BTW, I'm going to be in Thorndyke this weekend, just to check on things. Arrive late Friday night. Maybe I'll catch you if you're there. The best, Owen.
Fuck, he said aloud.
What?
Mira said. But again, he didn't answer. Darvish had told him he was coming home, and he had missed it. He turned to Mira.
I want you to go up to the house, he said. There's a farm vehicle by the kitchen door. I want you to drive it down here, slowly. Try not to make any noise, and don't turn on the lights.
No,
she said.
Mira, he said, fucking do it.
No,
she said again. She stepped back, away from him.
We should call the police. Put his phone back. You shouldn't be touching it. You should put it back in his pocket.
Lemoyne clenched his jaw tight to control his temper.
Okay, he said. Is that what you want? I put this back and we call the police.
Yeah,
Mira said, but her voice was high and strange.
So then the police come, said Lemoyne. And they ask what happened, right? Well, it's a homicide, first of all, right? That's pretty clear. It's manslaughter. That's bad for Shelley. She kills an innocent man on his own property, outside his own front door. That's a court case. That's a conviction right away. But then they find out she's high as a kite, and that steps it up a notch. That's drug use. That's reckless endangerment. That's driving under the influence. We're starting to look at years in prison. And then it turns out she's not the only one tripping off her nut. There's a whole gang of you. So now you're all a part of it, and it's trespassing, and it's theft, and it's destruction of property, and it's vandalism, because this guy did not know that you were here, Mira, and his widow doesn't either. What do you think she's going to think about it? And his kids? And this is a big story by now. It's all over the news, and up and down the country people are starting to say, hey, you know, I came home that one time and my backyard was all dug up. That was pretty spooky. Or they're saying, you know, I had that water bill a while back that was way too big to make sense, and it all starts coming out of the woodwork, how you guys have been doing this for years, creeping around behind people's backs, stealing, lying, cheating the taxman, breaking the law. This is the end of Burnham Wood, Mira. You're done. Shelley's fucking done. She's more than done. She's going to jail, no question. And she's got you to thank for it.
Mira was sobbing now.
But you gave her drugs, she said. And you changed the code on the gate. And you didn't hear the intercom.
You and me, said Lemoyne. We did this to her together. This is our fault. A man is dead because of us, Mira. But we can make it right.
We can't, she said. Everything is fucked. We're fucked.
No, said Lemoyne. We can take care of this.
Oh, God,
she said, sinking down to her knees.
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ.
Lemoyne crouched down next to her and gripped her shoulders in both his hands.
This was an accident, he said. Do you hear me? It was an accident. We can't bring this man back to life. We can't change the fact he's dead. But we can change what happens to Shelley. We can save her from spending the rest of her life in jail. And we can save Burnham Wood.
No, she said. Stop talking. Stop it.
He gripped her tighter.
Mira, look at me. We're not killing anybody. He's already dead. He died in an accident, in a terrible accident. And all we're going to do now is change the circumstances of that accident. That's all. And then we'll call the police. Of course we will. Just not until we're ready, all right? Not yet. Mira, you need to trust me. I've got this. I know what to do. I can take care of it. But we're in this together. Do you understand? This is a decision we need to make together.
She took a deep breath and held it, her eyes shut tight. In the van, Shelley was still counting.
121, 122, 123.
For her, said Lemoyne. We got her into this mess. We're going to get her out.
Mira opened her eyes again, but she wouldn't look at him. She nodded at the ground. He helped her to her feet.
Go and get the four-wheel drive and bring it back here quietly, he said. Make sure nobody sees you.
Every limitation could be turned to his advantage, she thought, as he watched Mira walk away into the dark. Every weakness, seen differently, could become a strength. Davis should let him know that he was coming home. Well then, Lemoyne had been waiting for him. They had been planning to discuss what they had hoped would be a joint financial venture, a lark cooked up between them, an idea that Lemoyne had first brought to Davish's attention weeks ago, that Davish had kept secret from his wife, perhaps, for reasons of his own. Except that Davish never made it home. He'd driven past his own front gate, for what reason nobody would ever know, and kept going, up to the lookout, up to the barricade where, mysteriously, he'd lost control of the car, damaging the fuel line as the SUV crashed down the cliff, perhaps, so that his body burned. Lemoyne was nodding. No witnesses. No one to blame. And it was plausible that Lemoyne would wait until the morning before he started wondering if anything was really, truly wrong. By which time the others would have sobered up, and he'd have had a chance to clean up the driveway and disappear the van. He went back to Davish's body and pressed the man's thumbprint to the sensor button for the third time, guessing that Davish was not the kind of man to have disabled his location services out of any fear his information would be stored and used against him. Sure enough, when Lemoyne accessed the map, he saw that the phone's present location was clearly marked. He was just about to disable the function and wipe the man's location history completely, when it occurred to him that perhaps Davish and his wife kept tabs on one another this way. Many couples did. And it might arouse her suspicion, he thought, if Davish were to stop using the location service on the very night he died. Lemoyne knew already that they knew all each other's passwords. Davish had mentioned it once in the kind of offhand boast that married people make, with false self-deprecation, rolling his eyes. Well, perhaps that could be turned to his advantage too. Lemoyne checked for any linked devices, but found none. Instead, he erased Davish's movements over the past half hour, and then disabled the service temporarily. Then he took his own phone out of his pocket, keeping the thumb of his other hand on Davish's home screen to prevent the display from going to sleep again. It was simple enough to make an email appear as though it had been sent and received some time ago. All one had to do was set one's clock to a time and date that had already passed, send the message, and then reset the clock to the present. The recipient's device would file the email as if it had really been received on that prior date. It would be marked unread, of course, but that was easily fixed if one had access to both devices. In fact, if one had access to both devices, one could insert an entire thread into the past, With a few keystrokes, Lemoyne could make it seem as though Darvish had known about Burnham Wood from the beginning. But he wouldn't overplay it. Less was more. He tapped away, holding his own phone in one hand and the dead man's in the other. Up at the house, he heard the distant cough of an engine coming to life, and a few seconds later, the farm vehicle came coasting down the hill, the engine much quieter than Lemoyne had expected it would be. He realized that Mira must have put the gear shift into neutral to coast down the hill. And this fact alone was enough to reassure him that she was with him, that she had made her decision, that she was in.
"See anyone?" he said, putting both phones away.
She shook her head.
"This next bit is going to be horrible," he said. "But it's the only thing you have to do, all right? And once it's done, I'll take care of everything else."
She nodded.
"We need to get him down to the gate and put him back in his car," said Lemoyne. "In the driver's seat. Do you think you can do that?"
She nodded again.
"He can't have any gravel on him," said Lemoyne. "We'll have to dust him off."
But she was already dismounting from the vehicle, going to the body, crouching down. Her face had a steely, vacant look, like a sleepwalker's. Lemoyne said nothing more. They knelt on either side of Darvish and lifted his torso until he was sitting upright, and then they lugged him to the four-wheel drive, Lemoyne carrying his head and shoulders, Mira his feet. Staggering slightly, they folded him into the back seat, and Lemoyne got in beside him to make sure he didn't topple out. Mira got back into the driver's seat and started the engine. Keeping the car in neutral, she released the parking brake and coasted down the hill to the gate, only jamming the gear stick into second when they approached the inner keypad, so she could lean out and press the button that opened the gate from the inside. They only had a few seconds to exit before the gates closed again. Mira drove neatly through the gap and pulled up beside the SUV. It was locked, and Lemoyne had to fish for a moment in Darvish's trouser pocket to find the key. They opened the driver's door and lugged his body from the four-wheel drive into the SUV, first dusting him down for any gravel that might have caught in his clothing, and checking the treads on the soles of his shoes. Lemoyne had just strapped him into his seatbelt and was backing out of the SUV to shut the door when his elbow jostled the car horn, and it blasted out into the night, causing both of them to jump.
"Sorry,"
he said. Mira said nothing. Her jaw was moving weirdly from side to side, as though she were chewing the inside of her cheek.
"I can take it from here," said Lemoyne. "Go back and be with Shelley."
"What about the van?"
"This first," he said. "Go."
"You've still got his phone."
"I'll put it back."
"You were touching it with your bare hands. Your fingerprints."
"I'll wipe it down," he said. "Don't worry. Go."
But she didn't move. She stared at him, barely an outline, her face a dark void.
"What are you going to do to him?"
she said.
"It's better you don't know," he said. "We're wasting time. I need you to go back and be with Shelley."
"You might need help," she said.
"I have help," Lemoyne almost said, but didn't.
Aloud, he said,
"Look, here's the story. You and I are going to meet with Owen Darvish tomorrow morning to talk about funding for going forward, and Shelley too, all three of us. You're excited. It's going to be the first time you meet this guy in person, this guy who knows you're here, who has known about you all along. You're looking forward to showing him what you've all been doing on his property these last few weeks, all right? Now go and practice it. Just say it over and over until you believe it. You're meeting Owen Darvish tomorrow to talk about funding Burnham Wood."
"What about the others?"
"Don't worry about the others right now. We can deal with them later. Just go."
She walked over to the keypad to let herself back in, reminding Lemoyne to change the code back to what it used to be before the night was over. But then she hesitated, her hand outstretched, her index finger pointing.
"Mira," he said, "we don't have time."
She turned to face him.
"This is why we were fighting," she said. "Me and Shelley. She wanted to tell the others about meeting up with Darvish tomorrow, and I didn't. I wanted to keep it secret."
"Good," said Lemoyne. "That works."
"That's why she came after me,"
Mira said, sounding inexpressibly relieved.
"Yeah, that works."
Lemoyne nodded. He watched, hands on hips, as she punched the numbers into the keypad, and the iron gates swung wide to admit her.